people deal with the change like a storm, and they expect after the storm, the sun will rise and everything will go calm. So speaking about change, we got the guru of the change. Welcome to the show, John.
Ah, my pleasure. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, in our show, we start exploring the guest through his or her purpose in life. What is your purpose in life?
To bring more optimism to decision makers in the world. I think that optimism is a superpower, and most people don't realize how much energy optimism actually gives them. And it's a skill that you have to develop, especially in times of uncertainty. So to be optimistic in times of certainty is an easy game. To be optimistic in times of uncertainty shows that you are accessing an explorer archetype. And it's that explorer archetype of courage and hope is what I want decision makers to have, especially in what's going on at the moment. So optimism for decision makers is my mission.
But usually optimism coming with the change and uncertainty, they look like an opposite.
Of course.
Terminology.
Well, even you saying that shows you that the way we've always planned our lives is based on some addiction to certainty. Even what your statement is, but hang on, how can you be optimistic when times are uncertain? Because you're linking optimism to certainty. And that's the way the brain has been programmed, because of the educational system, because of the economies of scale process, because of the efficiencies becoming priority with profitability. It's always an addiction to that certainty. And when that isn't certain, we become anxious, we become flustered. And that's only because of the programming and software that we've been designed to practice because of educational systems and organizational systems. But the system itself is now crumbling because the system itself just doesn't make sense. I mean, America just keeps printing money. Now there's Bitcoin. Now you find so many accountants playing number games. I mean, so like education used to guarantee you something. It doesn't guarantee. I mean, like everything's up for question now. So we have to realize that there is no certainty. Just like you said, when the storm finishes, there's no calmness coming. The storm is getting stormier. There's no calm. There shouldn't be an expectation of calm. There should be an expectation of your ability to deal with whatever's coming. And that becomes the superpower that we need to be thinking about.
Okay, so usually the purpose of every person has a background and foundation. So dealing with uncertainty and being optimistic at the same time, does this impact your foundation at the beginning, early in your life? How did you come with this purpose? There's a reason for that you came with that purpose.
You know, I think my journey in itself was very addicted to certainty. And one step deeper is I come from a single mom family, and I had a deep desperation for alpha male acknowledgement because I didn't have a dad. I didn't know this. I mean, this is me now in retrospect, thinking about my life. And so I developed a life in my 20s that looked very, very successful from the outside, but it was desperate for acknowledgement and just desperate for success, just to get to be seen, I guess, you know? And after that, at about 31, I went bankrupt. I lost everything. And I went from many houses, many cars, many businesses to living in my friend's second bedroom. And I changed my name to Carlos because I didn't even have a car. I lost my car. And so much happened that I started to realize that I had to start to redesign the way I was thinking about my life, because I thought I was doing everything right. And I obviously wasn't. And it's that through that process of self-development from about 31 years old, where I realized that just being ambitious and focused and addicted to certainty is not guaranteeing you anything. In fact, even the process of doing that is stressful. It's incredibly uncomfortable. And you actually don't ever arrive when you're dealing with that level of anxiousness and need for acknowledgement. And so that self-development process that began after the bankruptcy has gotten me to the place today where I realize that the real superpower is adaptability, only because of my own progression and my own self-development through the process. And it's now landing at almost the right time, because organizations need to find this optimism out there. This was never the mission. This was just my own process that's now become part of my work and what I teach.
Okay. I cannot get rid of this foundation before we go to our main subject. One last question on that section. You move from the extreme right to the extreme left, from being a very certain life, looks a very successful, to extremely vocal on the other side. Do you consider yourself at this moment of your life on the other side or a moderate point as we speak now?
Well, it just depends what scale you're measuring it against.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, the scale itself is, I don't know, maybe for some people I'm moderate and some people I'm too far left. Look, I'm nomadic. I don't have a house. I travel the world. That's quite extreme for some people, you know? But there's other people that have less than me and travel even more than me. So I'm moderate for them. What I like to think is that I've gotten to the point in my life, I'm close to 50 years old, is I've gotten to understand that success needs to be measured in your own measurement stick, you know? When you're comparing, you really aren't giving yourself any real credit, because most of the time when you're comparing, you diminishing yourself. You're not comparing yourself to people that you're doing better than. You're comparing yourself to people that's doing better than you. And so I think that game in itself is a horrible game to play, because your internal dialogue is one of self-infliction rather than self-encouragement. And so success for me looks like spontaneity, freedom, health, barefoot on as many beaches around the world while making great money and telling stories. And so I've got this mix of what I call being an urban monk. I love cities, but I meditate 2 hours a day.
Okay, we're going to come to meditation in a few seconds.
Sure.
So now let's move with our main subject today. So now, you shared your point about being about uncertainty and how we navigate uncertainty, where change now is becoming constant. You can see that every change is coming more frequent than before. The pace of the change is getting faster and faster. We thought about the political situation between Russia and Ukraine will be the final one, and it will be resolved. And look what's going on around now as we speak. So in that sense, what is your view? We have two aspects to address today, individuals and companies. From an individual point of view, how individuals can navigate uncertainty, and then later on we're going to touch base on the organizations and companies.
So let's remember that everything in our lives works in cycles. We have seasons. Summer, winter, autumn, spring, these are seasons. Even in our lifetimes, we go from baby to toddler to young child to young person, adult, old person, mature person. Everything cycles. Everything's in cycles. There's a great book called The Fourth Turning, where they explain in their research that every 80 years, humanity goes through a cycle. It's called the saeculum. And in the saeculum, you have four seasons. You have spring, summer, autumn, and winter. And the last time an 80-year cycle ended, according to their research, was 1946 with World War II. And in the 20 years leading up to the end of that cycle, what we had was social unrest, political divide, financial collapse, and war. Sound familiar?
Yes.
That's exactly what's going on right now. So every 80 years we have this. We have the same characters pitching up every 80 years trying to keep the old world alive. Back then it was Mussolini and Hitler. Today it's Putin and Trump and whoever else is now trying to keep the old world alive. Not evolve, but keep the old world alive. So when we think about the destruction and the uncertainty around us, let's just remember that in winter, which is what we are in, the crisis aspect, the fourth turning of the 80-year cycle, we always have the demise of the old structures. And according to their research, it ends in 2028, 2030. So we still have another 7 or 8 years of demise, implosion, and destruction in order for a new world to be birthed. And so we realize that the wars, the financial crises, the change of the superpower that's happening in the world right now, where America and the Western world's dwindling, and we're not seeing Saudi and UAE and these places starting to feel so confident. You know, you tour Europe and America, there's no confidence in those people. They're disgruntled. They're entitled and disgruntled. And that's what happens at the end of every empire. I imagine the Romans and the Egyptians were exactly the same, entitled and disgruntled, because things weren't like they used to be. And then you come here to Dubai, and I was at a talk this morning, and there was a minister speaking. The enthusiasm, the optimism. And that was just in America, and there's zero of that. So let's firstly understand why there's so much change, is that we're in a cycle of change. We're not in the cycle of spring, we're in the cycle of winter, which shows that we need this demise. So when we think about our individual capacity to deal with this, the first thing we have to do is realize where we are in the cycle. You know, if you have to wake up every morning and you think it's summer, but you're expecting it to be summer, but it's winter, you're a very upset person. But if you wake up every morning and you realize we're in winter, you're like, oh, okay, I see why that tree's leaves are falling off. I need to cultivate this plant. I need to do what I do in winter. So where we are right now is exactly where we need to be to see a new world being birthed. And so let's first unhook ourselves from this addiction to certainty and expectation of how things need to be and used to be. That's not going to happen. We're moving into a new world. And that's why the ability to be adaptable in this change becomes the most important thing we can do, because the future is not about what's coming. It's about how you're reacting to what's coming. We don't know what's coming. Think about everything we implicitly trusted. Education used to guarantee you something. It guarantees you nothing today. The fastest growing religion in the world is no religion. I know we're in an area with high religious numbers, but in the world at large, no religion is the fastest growing religion. So the concept of that solace is gone for many people. That North Star is gone. Think about marriage. I mean, 56% of marriages fail, and that's just the brave enough people who stepped up for divorce. Think about all the things that we used to implicitly trust, the news, politics, the economics, all of it's up for question. So let's first understand where we are in this process. We're all in this boat together. It's not you, it's not your business, it's not your career, it's not your marriage, it's everybody that's going through this. So as an individual, we have to firstly, foremost, realize where we are in the cycle. Two, understand that our experience in this 200 years of industrial revolution education has brought us into a place where we are addicted to something called a high beta brainwave. And it's this high beta brainwave that makes us anxious, adrenaline fueled, and addicted to certainty. And think about this, when you were at school, it wasn't so much about learning, but did you pass? And did you pass your standard? It's like, what you had to do what you had to do. You pull all night to do what you have to do. You have to cheat, whatever. Whatever has to, let's just pass. Then you go to university and everybody's not saying, what did you learn? They said, did you get your degree? It's not about the process, it's about the outcome. Then you go to work and everybody's like, yeah, yeah, kumbaya, culture. Oh, you didn't make your numbers. Okay, bye. Addiction to certainty. So we have this addiction to certainty everywhere. And so what has happened is, because of this push constantly in a linear line to efficiencies, profitability at 100% all the time, we've developed a brainwave that tells us we're in constant danger. We're anxious. We are fueled with this adrenaline. We're on edge all the time. And we don't even know why we're on edge. Why are we rushing? What's the point of rushing? To get home to watch TV? What, everybody's rushing. The whole world's rushing. And we can see that with all the technology and all the capital in the world, more than ever before, we have a higher numbers of anxiousness, loneliness, anger, use of pharmaceuticals. Prozac is selling better than ever before. There's more alcohol being consumed. What is that? That shows us that we are desperate to somehow bring some calmness to our lives. Somehow. We don't know how. But the trick really is to understand brainwaves and neuroscience, because what neuroscience and brainwaves start to teach us is that we experience time differently from different brainwaves. We experience realities in different ways when we just change our brainwave from a high beta to an alpha brainwave. And when you start to understand the process of how the brain works and how your personality has been created because of neurons that have been wiring and firing together for decades, and your personality is now concretified into already deciding what you think about money, about people, about weather, but you've already made those decisions. Those are already embedded into your subconscious. And so now what's going to start happening is you realize that because you're in this high beta brainwave, you're so anxious that you're not wanting to change anything. It's exactly the opposite of being adaptable. The minute you start meditating and doing trauma healing and start playing and doing, and I'll come to all of these and we can unpack them, active imagination, what you start to do is you start to make your brain more relaxed, just simply more relaxed. And in that state of being more relaxed, you get the opportunity to unwire and unfire your personality traits. And in that process, you start to unlearn old behaviors and start to change an awareness. And that new awareness starts to build and see new solutions that were not otherwise available to you. Now, it was Einstein who said it best. He said, you cannot solve a problem from the same awareness that created it. And so we have to change our awareness. It was Alvin Toffler who said the illiterate of the 21st century will not be the ones who cannot read and cannot write, but the ones who cannot unlearn to relearn. And so you have to ask yourself, how do I change my awareness and how do I unlearn at pace? At pace. And that comes down to changing your brainwaves and understanding that when you are highly stressed, you don't have enough time. Time is always running out. You have a to-do list that never ends. You're constantly tired. The minute you move into an alpha brainwave, you have more than enough time. You have a super lateral in the way you think. You're more creative than ever before. You're calmer in the way you make decisions. And the last time you were in an alpha brainwave, mostly people, is before you go on holiday, you're in a high beta brainwave. You hate everybody. Everything's terrible. You are not as successful as you want to be. Your wife's terrible. Your husband's terrible. Whatever. Your children are idiots. All of that stuff. Your boss is a bigger idiot. But look, 4 or 5 days into holiday, I don't know, everything starts to change. You start to change. You start to relax.
True.
10 days on holiday and you're like, oh my God, I'm a new person. I'm now making lists of all the things I should do when I get back to work and to life. I should be more kinder with, I should spend more time with my kids. I should. You become lateral in your thinking, calmer in your heart. And now you're creative. Now you really got time to be creative. But the minute we get back to work, 3 hours back at work, and we'll say the words, I can't even remember I was on holiday. But what you did is you changed brainwave from alpha to beta. But the future, we realize that beta and high beta brainwaves is this analytical addiction to certainty, algorithmic intelligence that's attached to it. Computers do that better. Mm. AI does that better. And so we have to realize that our actual future of the way we access creativity is based on us changing brainwaves from high beta to alpha, because beta has become commoditized. Everybody's doing it. Computers are doing it. We need to now access a new type of currency, which is a totally different type of currency. It's not algorithmic intelligence, which is what we've been prized for 200 years.
Okay, so I have two questions here. Beta and alpha were created for a reason. There is a reason for both brainwaves to be used. So first of all, you made beta waves like an evil and alpha like an angel in the way articulated both. I agree with all what you said. So that's my first question. What is the reason for beta waves in our brain? Second,
let me answer that.
Okay, go ahead.
High beta brainwave is absolutely necessary when you're in danger.
Okay.
But people think they're in danger all the time. They become addicted to danger.
Define danger. It's a relative concept.
Adrenaline. Are you feeling edgy? Are you feeling on edge? Do you think you have enough time? Are you encouraging inside your own brain towards yourself? Mm. Do you think your employees or your colleagues all love you? And you think that you're adding value all the time? Do you think you're making more enough money? Like, are you fully self-accepting and self-forgiving? Have you healed all your relationships around you? No, most people haven't. That's high beta. The minute you move your brainwave, now let's remember, most of the world's addicted to high beta without realizing they're addicted to high beta because they think adrenaline is normal. It's not normal. It should be there a little bit. Mid beta and low beta are great because when I'm on stage, I'm low beta. But most people don't go into low beta. They go straight into high beta. Mm. And what alpha does, it allows you to access a different personality. And I think it's a much more angelic personality. In fact, the frequency of an alpha brainwave is the same frequency as nature. Mm. It's symbiotic with what's going on in the world. Rather than us forcing nature, we become part of nature. We're not the gods of nature. We are part and parcel of it. So yes, I do think that it's important for us to highlight that it is a bad thing to be addicted to 24 hours a day, 365 days a year for years, which is what people are. Hmm. That's why diseases are through the roof. And that because it's like revving your car in second gear at 7,000 revs. Like how long can you do that for? Hmm. You can't, it'll bust. And that's what's happening. So yes, I am purposefully making high beta evil because I want people to realize that you've been caught up in a story that's not necessary.
Okay. Back to the second question. When you were 31 years old, have you ever consumed or been addicted to high beta waves at that time?
All the time.
At that time.
Of course.
That's why you made the shift.
But I only made the shift recently because for many years I relied on psychology. I studied, I did personal development, I read all the psychological books, I wrote psychological books, I taught psychology. But today we realize that psychology is what I call software. This software that we've been updating for the last 200 years using therapy, using psychology, is becoming less relevant. And you can see because everybody's read Brené Brown. Everybody's watched Simon Sinek. We've all done everything we were supposed to do, but we're still anxious. We're still fearful of uncertainty, which means that software upgrading needs to be replaced by hardware upgrading. And hardware upgrading is brainwaves and neuroscience. It's what holds the software. Hmm. So now let me ask you, if you had to take an iPhone 1 and load up iOS 17 onto it, what would happen?
It would crash.
Exactly. Hmm. And so what's happening to our society? We're crashing because our brains are addicted to certainty, not uncertainty. So we have to unhook ourselves. And the only way we can do that is moving brainwaves and changing the hardware. Now, when you start to change the hardware, you can start adding new software. Okay. And through the process of meditation, what you're doing is you're defragging your computer and allowing stillness, allowing more space. And in that space, you start to access new types of creativity that you didn't even know were available to you because you were so busy running. And you didn't even know you were running.
Hmm. Okay. Now, let's move from the individuals to the companies and organization. With this uncertainty, people more than shift every day. Product in the market shift every day. The consumer and the market become so fragmented, and companies feel that they are not fitting or relevant for tomorrow as we speak now. How companies can navigate the uncertainty on a company scale?
What we have to think about is the world's largest businesses making decisions that have seen them come short. Let me give you a couple examples. Zara was worth $19 billion pre-COVID. Today it's worth $13 billion, losing market share. H&M is closing stores around the world. And what started to happen is that there's a new kid on the block. It's called Shein.
Yes.
And Shein is worth over $110 billion. And it's like 8 years old. I don't know, 10 years old, like young. And the guy who owns it is not even in clothing. He's a machine learning SEO data scientist. That's what he does. And so he scrapes the internet for the clothes that you and I have liked the most. And then computer generates 10 variations in 20 different colors, puts up 10,000 new styles onto his website, hasn't manufactured one unit yet. Zara's manufactured billions of units, transported them around the world, design teams around the world. Shein just came and ate their pie right in front of their face and they didn't even see it. And now you have Mercedes-Benz and BMW being very slow in competing against Chinese electric cars, and Tesla, they're starting to eat their market share. There's panic in Germany because it's combustion engines, the production's not really what we're after anymore. Then you realize that Google was a bit short and OpenAI beat them to the market and now worth $90 billion. Worth at $90 billion. Google was sleeping. NASA couldn't think of SpaceX. So let's understand that the smartest people in the world with the most legacy in their industries cannot see new opportunities ahead of them because of the level of awareness that they have and educational system they've created because of the economies of scale system. So the leaders we have in the world today are excellent at economies of scale. They're so addicted to profit and quarterly profits that they don't even know that they're so addicted to it. It's so intertwined into their heads. They're so programmed for it that they can't even think adaptively. So what I always suggest is stop trying. Just stop trying. Don't. You can't. Because nobody, the biggest, smartest brains couldn't see it. What do you think? You're going to see it? So I always suggest is build a tomorrow team. You have a today team that's focused on the next 12 to 18 months. You've got a strategy that's about innovation and efficiency. And in my world, innovation is doing what you've always done more modified, more efficiently. And so you keep innovating, keep having incremental changes, keep net profits high, do that. But don't ask the same person to think about tomorrow and new disruptive ways and build new business models and become a machine learning specialist and think about your sector in totally different ways. You have to build new capabilities to think about what's coming next, because Zara couldn't see it, Mercedes-Benz couldn't see it, Google couldn't see it. What do you think? You're going to see it? You're not. And so for me, organizational restructuring looks very simple. You have a Boeing, and this Boeing is your big company. It's today. It's focused on efficiencies. It's still necessary. But you need a jet fighter that's going out to seeing what's out there and attacking what's out there and building capabilities to build it and to beat it. And a jet fighter only has one pilot. You don't need a lot of people. And in today's world, with the advent of AI, we'll start slowly seeing the world's first billion-dollar company with three employees. And if you think that's far-fetched, remember that Instagram got sold for $1 billion with 12 employees. And that was a long time ago. And today with AI, we're going to start to seeing organizations, three employees, $1 billion turnover. What does that mean? Does that mean the capabilities inside this organization, just like Shein to a certain extent, is tech-focused? You outsource everything else. You create the data and the machine learning systems to try and tackle as many different problems out there as possible. This is not a skill set of a big organization. I go into boardrooms and execs, and the first question I ask is, who here is the AI specialist? Nobody. What about the data scientist? Nobody. So what do you all have? Oh, no, we're engineers and lawyers. Yes, they were very relevant. They were. They're just not relevant moving forward. And that's okay, because many of us have to reinvent ourselves, including myself.
You mentioned creating tomorrow team and sending a jet fight with one pilot. Jet fight is super expensive. I know it has one pilot only. This is one. When it comes to business leader, they have short-term goals and long-term goals.
Mm-hmm.
And shareholders, market price, uncertainty,
mm-hmm.
quarterly review, board meeting is every 3 months. This is a very short period of time. What kind of advice will give it to business leader to sacrifice short-term resources just to send a one jet flight to explore what's going on in the world and come back with a few ideas, and these ideas, one of them will be successful or none out of them. How to balance between being innovative for the future and sacrifice some resources for the short term where you're dying for every single resource you have now. You see what I'm saying?
Great question. But I don't think that the aspect of the jet fight I was talking about was about the expensive part. It was about the nimble part.
Okay.
And so I wasn't talking about the price, because the price to set up a tomorrow team is a fraction of what your today team costs. A fraction, maybe a hundredth, like not even. And so you're not really talking about big numbers. If you think about what like Japan Airlines did, they built a tomorrow team. And what they did was, is they ran a competition, a hackathon. They put $70 million into it. And they had this hackathon, a global competition where they asked young entrepreneurs to come up with the future of travel.
Hmm.
And so what they developed is the company that won is called Limitless Travel X. And it's got nothing to do with an airplane. It's got nothing to do with an airport. It's got to do with these humanoid robots that are positioned around the world. And you can hire them for an hour. And you put on goggles, earphones, and a haptic suit. And you can feel exactly what the robot's feeling. You can walk where the robot's walking. So if you and I want to go to Paris, we can hire two robots. They're in Champs-Élysées. We can see what they're seeing. We can talk to each other. We can hear what's going on. We can feel the cold. We can feel the heat. Will that become the future of travel? I don't know. Is Japan Airlines 20 steps ahead of every other airline? Yes, they are. Are they maybe creating a new income stream that they otherwise wouldn't have? Yes, absolutely they are. Will this become the future? We don't know, but they're playing. Other airlines are stuck. They're just hoping that what they're doing right now is what they're doing, and that's going to be the same.
Hmm.
And so you have to realize that leadership has to change. The addiction to these net profits and quarterly profits is a ridiculous way to think about planting seeds for tomorrow. So you're not going to plant any seeds for tomorrow because I'm so addicted to exactly what I've always been doing. I mean, listen to that. Like, to think about how that sounds. It sounds like you're a petulant teenage boy who doesn't, I'm not thinking about tomorrow. I only want to think about today. And it's unfortunate that the whole system is built for an old life, an old world. This old system doesn't work. Think about Zara, economies of scale. They're not beating a company that's working on something called economies of learning. It's a totally different business model. Zara didn't see it. Zara's lost $6 billion in market share. Is that not enough motivation? $6 billion market share gone. H&M closing stores. And so what most people think, and you know, Etty Salat and E&, have been excellent because they've done that. They've built a tomorrow team. E&, is their tomorrow team. They're playing. Is that not enough? I mean, do organizations think that they are safe for the long run, and every other industry is becoming disrupted and demonetized and democratized? And so you've also got to ask yourself as an executive, how smart are you? Because if you're still caught up on these quarterly profits because that's the way it's always been done, what does that mean? It means you're just ready to get disrupted. Somebody's building something that's going to start taking you out. Think about the telco sector. I was in South Africa speaking for Vodafone, and the CEO of Vodafone in South Africa stood up and said, it's so funny, you know, we're changing our whole business model. They changed their whole business model to become digital transformation partners for organizations, away from selling airtime and data and those things. And it's all for because of one app that we are all using called WhatsApp. We are cannibalizing our own business. And so this happens sector after sector after sector. And if you're caught up into that quarterly profit routine and habit, it's only to your own demise, because we keep seeing this over and over and over.
Okay, so I get what you're saying. Let me address another point in your question. So every organization, including Vodafone, Zara, E&, they have, I assume, innovation team, they have R&D team, they have their own continuous improvement, reducing cost, more efficiency. They have target in the next year to enhance our footprint and reduction on XYZ. What's the difference between this department in any organization now and tomorrow team?
Yeah, you're talking about innovation. That's perfect. R&D for your existing business. Yes, absolutely. People that sit inside your office that have got the same KPIs as everybody else, which is quarterly.
Yes.
But so what does that mean? You're in today. You just do, keep doing it. Today is important. There's a great saying that says, we don't know who discovered water, but we know it's not, wasn't a fish. Okay? It's exactly what you're saying. There's another saying. It says, you cannot read the label of the bottle from inside the bottle. You have to be outside the bottle. So we're kidding ourselves thinking that we in our existing guise are going to come up with totally new business models and disruptive ideas. We have an immunity system, a legacy thinking, a personality that's built around the industry that you're in. Banking is never disrupted by bankers. You know, NASA wasn't disrupted by a space guy. Elon Musk, not a space guy. You know, Mercedes-Benz Tesla didn't arrive from a car guy. He's not a car guy. He's a different guy. And so you have to ask yourself, like, how much are you actually thinking about tomorrow? And you think that your R&D plans are going to make it. And I guess what? They will for the next year or two. But the business models that they're developing those ideas on are based on economies of scale and efficiency, not economies of learning. Because it goes against their understanding of things. So you have to bring in these young guns with data science and gaming and these guys and get them to start thinking about your sector and your business. Think about Japan Airlines. Do you think any of their R&D teams inside Japan Airlines would have come up with a robot? No way. Like, it's impossible. You know, it just doesn't make sense.
They may change the shape of the window.
Exactly. they would do surveys and studies and they would say, okay, easier check-ins, more comfortable. I mean, what would they think? They would think that. And I think that's necessary. I don't think it's not necessary. But don't kid yourself. That's what I keep telling executives I work with. Like, the biggest companies in the world don't see it. What do you think is going to happen? Like, why would you think you would be the messiah that would see it? And I won't see it. I've got to build those teams as well.
Okay. That was a very good point. If I move to the next point, when it comes to creating value. So I remember a very small business used to be there in 20s, 1999, which is Cyber Cafe. Remember the Cyber Cafe?
Internet cafes.
So they open a small shop with few computers and you rent for 1 hour and then you go and everyone started this business everywhere. And then people thought that that would be the new business model. So it was disruptive that other businesses closing like stationery or any other business because of the internet. And then this new business arise. And then they taught us in the school, and you know, this, that whenever there is a change, some business disappear and other business arise, which is like creating value. The market will be in the same 100% as a business, but then some stuff will completely disappear and other stuff will arise. With an AI coming in, that's my question. When AI is coming in, a lot of stuff will disappear. And you know that. It's already disappeared as we speak now. Not well. But then what kind of potential that the new thing that AI and beyond AI as well will happen that will create other stuff that we don't know and will create value, will create jobs, or will make human life better?
What's the question?
The question here, do you think AI will bring value? When I say value, doesn't mean shareholders to the rich people, if I may say. I mean to the common man that will lose his or her job.
So let's just firstly understand one thing, is that if you don't elevate and evolve yourself, you will lose your job.
Aligned.
Absolutely. Are you a farmer? Do you know any farmers? No, but 200 years ago, 99% of the population were farming. Today, 1.3% of the population farm. So what does that mean? It means we can't be farmers anymore. So we evolved. We developed educational systems. We developed analytical thinking. We developed accountants, lawyers. These are 200 years old. They weren't around before that. And so we realized that the way we think about jobs today and the way we think about adding value today are absolutely disruptable by AI. And be 100% sure that billions of very smart, highly regarded, highly paid people will soon be useless, including myself. And if you think about it as a strategist, the best thing you could do is ask ChatGPT for a strategy. I mean, they're brilliant. The things I've asked it and it's given me, I'm like, whoa, I've never even thought of that in any way or any guise. And then you think about authors, done. I mean, you can write 5 books tomorrow if you want. And then think about all services. all services, from nutritionists to architects to, I'm so sorry, accountants to lawyers to me, strategists, speakers, all of it is up for question. I don't know at what stage, at where, in what guise it will become disrupted, but all services are up for question. And so we have to ask ourselves is, how are you actually engaging with AI? Are you scared of it? Are you engaging with it? Are you adding something positive to it? Are you engaging with it to use it for a good thing? But I do think just like electricity today is accessible to everybody, most people, AI will be accessible to everybody. It'll become that cheap and that easy for us to engage with. Like the internet is accessible to 5 billion people. AI will just add another layer to that efficiency. Today, anybody can order food delivered to them in 30 minutes. I mean, think about that. From any nation in the world. I mean, what? That's unbelievable. You can watch any entertainment, watch any subject. This is everybody's got access to it. How much has it improved our lives? In some ways, fantastically. In some ways, it's made us more lonely and anxious than ever before. So we have to figure that out as well. But of course, AI will be accessible to everybody. And remember that converging technologies and AI are making sector after sector free. Hmm. And also, like, you might not have a job. But firstly, if you don't have a job, you haven't elevated and evolved yourself, because there's lots of people making money out there. Just the old ways of making money are starting to become demise. So we have to think about new ways. So that is your responsibility to unlearn and change your awareness to find new solutions. That is your very, very deep personal responsibility that you have. But also, if we're not evolving and elevating, our jobs get taken away. But also remember that everything's becoming free. So think about music. Do you listen to pay? Do you buy CDs? Do you know? You get so much music thrown at you through YouTube. And it costs you nothing. Wi-Fi hotspot, you're done. Communication. I mean, I know in UAE we pay because WhatsApp's banned, but how much messages do you send back and forth and voice notes? It costs nothing. Hmm. It's free. Then think about photos. You can take a gazillion photos and share them. Free. Think about entertainment. You have so much entertainment thrown at you. It's free. Next is transport. Next is power generation. Next is services. The extrapolation of technology is making things free. We all are becoming much more educated, much more accessible to services in so many different ways. So already it's uplifting our lives. Just add another layer of intelligence to it big time. But this, we shouldn't be scared of this. This is something that's improving. Are you scared of electricity? No.
No.
But it disrupted industry after industry back then. But today it's AI. It's going to happen faster and quicker, and it's really attacking our level of intelligence. And that's the scary part. But we made it past electricity. We made it past the combustion engine. In fact, we're thriving than ever before in many ways. And so again, I think the future is plural. It's futures. You choose which one you want to live in. You know, you it's your choice. Some people are having horrific times and other people are thriving. What's the difference? Their perspective, their neuroscience, their creativity, their collaborative thinking, their optimism, their energy. That's what's the difference. There's no other difference. Some pockets are making, some pockets are losing. You choose which one you want to be in. You're not a victim of it.
I see what you're saying. So if you see, I know you should not be threatened from the technology, same as electricity, good example that you choose. But if I tell you now that you're going to lose your job as a strategist, you're going to lose your job as a writer as well. You're going to lose your job as a speaker in the stage. We're going to get an AI with a fabulous message, driving
in 10 languages.
In different languages, exactly. With so energy, exactly. With emotions and everything.
Of course.
Then let me ask a personal question.
Yes.
What are you doing to adapt the new world?
Of course. That's a good question. And firstly, do I look stressed?
No, not at all.
I'm not stressed at all. Because I also understand that my job is to firstly accept it. Just by you accepting it, you relax yourself.
Okay.
And the fact that we're threatened by it is because of a high beta brainwave. Everything is threatening. It's not just AI. Everything is threatening. But I've been meditating for 3 years now. And because of this process, I have a calmer approach to it. So actually, I can be creative in the way that I explore what's next. Not scared about, oh my God, my job's getting taken. No, I'm already exploring many different businesses. I'm looking, and I know that I can guarantee this, is that the future requires a lot more human touch, human experience, human connection. That is a currency that is not going anywhere. And we can see this because holidays, hotels, airports, airlines are booming. They can't keep up with the number of people. What are people doing? Paying for experiences. They're wanting to share, connect, see, taste. This human experience is going nowhere. So if you want to think of something you want to do, is what is the skill set that you have and how can you apply that to human experience in whatever guise you want, and start to experiment there. Have your own little tomorrow team. And so, well, that's what I've done. I've got two or three pockets of businesses around the world with different partners, and I'm just playing, I'm experimenting. And I'm not, if something happens, great. If it doesn't happen, I don't know. I'm just moving along, figuring it out. Nobody knows. We're just trying new things. And so approaching it like that is called adaptability.
Hmm.
Not approaching it like that is called fixed mindset, which means you're stuck and you don't even know you're stuck. And so it's such an easy process. Hard to rewire yourself and to unlearn old patterns, but easy once you get into that flow.
Okay. I think you have your own tomorrow team, right?
In my head.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
Yes, I do.
So you're exploring your own futures as well with a
big time.
With a creativity and calm mindset, not panic mindset. Exactly. Because panic will not get you anywhere.
But even your question is like, what are you gonna do? You're gonna lose your job at author and this and this.
The question as well is beta question.
It's a beta question. I'm so glad you can see that. The question itself is a bit of a panic. It's like, oh my God, what are you gonna do with yourself? You know, you're gonna be on the streets. No, I'm not. I mean, I'll figure something out. I've lived an unbelievable life as a global speaker and traveling around the world. And on Saturday, I go to New York, and on Wednesday, I'm in Mexico. And this is fantastic. Will it last forever? I don't know if I want it to last forever. I'm having a great time now, you know? So we'll see what comes next.
Okay. So with you, time flies, as you can see. I couldn't feel the time. It is already 45 minutes. My final question for you, the Gen Z, the new generation. I know your views about Gen Z, that we're far away from us to give them any advice.
Yes.
Or any, like the traditional interview, can you please give advice to the new people joining the new organization? I think it should be the other way around.
I agree. That would be my answer.
Exactly. But yeah. I mean, if you can just share some light to the Gen Z, what is your observation on the new generation?
The few that I've engaged with, and I don't know them on the whole, but the few that I've engaged with have this duality of wanting to be aloof, but also the center of attraction, the center of attention. Mm. They want you to see them, but they're too cool to be engaging. So they're there, but they're not there. They're there, they're not there. They're like, so they're in that age. I don't know if it's an age thing or a culture or a generational thing. I have no idea. But every generation arrives to buck the trends. And think about Gen Z. They don't even want to fit into our genders. They're like, what gender? What's male? What's female? Mm. I don't want to be part of that.
Mm.
And we're like, oh my God, how dare you? Are you crazy? But every generation does this. I mean, think about 30 years ago, being gay was the worst thing in the world. Today, it's like, yeah, it's no problem. Yeah, good for you. Like, yeah, khalas, move on, you know, keep going. And so we have to realize that this new generation again is pushing our buttons. They don't want to do the things like we did them. And also, I don't think we do. I don't even think we want to do things like we've always done them. You know, who wants to work 9 to 5 constantly for the rest of your life? Who? Show me somebody. You've been indoctrinated to think that's exactly what you need to do. So you're like, yes, 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 sir. I'm going to go do that because I've been told to do that. But actually, if you start to listen to your heart and you start to access your genius, you would never want to do that, ever.
Mm.
And so I think they're showing us a new way. And as every older generation, we think we're smarter. You know, your grandfather thinks he's smarter than you, and his grandfather thought he was smarter than him. And we have this ridiculous notion that we think we know it all because we've lived a life. But I think in today's world, the older generation know nothing about the future. And no disrespect to anybody listening, even me at close to 50, when I listen to a 15-year-old and 18-year-old, I know nothing about the future. But I know that. But I think the older generation have some false notion of their knowledge and wisdom. And I think maybe emotionally you might have it right. Maybe. Lots of men in their 60s are young children who sulk and throw their toys out the cot. And we can see this. And so many wars being raged around the world based on trigger points and trauma that they haven't healed. And these are men in their 60s and 70s still sulking, still throwing their toys out the cot.
Hmm.
And so hopefully emotionally you've got it. But as far as adding value in a world of the future, no offense, but you have no idea.
Mm.
Guess what? Neither do we. But we're experimenting and we're trying it out. And when I say we, I don't think I'm a Gen Z, but I'm playing like they are. I'm trying to be like them in many ways. But I think it's an exciting thing to watch them and allow them to evolve and allow them to add value in the world the way they want to. And think about Mr. Beast. You know Mr. Beast?
Yeah.
Of course, Gen Z, 200 million followers on YouTube, makes hundreds of millions of dollars doing it his way. And that's what every one of these Gen Zs want. They're desperate for their uniqueness. They're desperate to want to be seen in the world the way they want to be seen. And he's a great example of it because he's taking apart businesses like Netflix, who's run by baby boomers and Gen Xers. And he has a Gen Z alone in the middle of America who's got a bigger media channel than the biggest media channels in the world combined. Gen Z. So I celebrate them. I don't just celebrate them. I interrogate them when I meet them. I ask them 250 questions. Who are you watching? What are you watching? Why are you watching it? What are you eating? What are you wearing? Why are you wearing that? Why is that cool? Who made that? Who's just ask them 1,000,000,000 questions because I want to have a reverse mentor. I want to learn from them about what's cool, what's not cool, and see what aligns with me and what doesn't align with me. I think it was, I can't remember, but he said, God forbid that you want your kids to be like you, and God willing, you want to be like your kids. So we must stop trying to mold them into us. We must almost be moving more towards them. They have the adaptability and freedom and concept of creativity very different to us. Correct. And so I think they are fascinating to watch. And I'm sure they're going to be a very powerful generation, like all of us are. Like every generation is amazing in some certain ways. We like to call millennials lazy, but you know, who wants to work 9 to 5 constantly for their whole life and then retire at 65 and die at 70? Is that the right? Are we measuring it according to that? Mm. Exactly. So that we also have to realize that the measuring stick might be wrong, actually.
True.
Yeah. Gotcha.
I think that was fabulous discussion, John. I think that the energy is coming out of the mic from what you shared. And every generation is unique and relevant to the time that this generation is already born in as well.
And let's celebrate. Maybe
exactly. Yeah. So in that sense, we need to accommodate and celebrate and learn. I agree with you. It should be the other way around.
Absolutely.
Not the traditional question.
Yeah.
John, it was really a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for accepting the invite.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.